RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
The NZSIS has released declassified historical records from the Second World War and Soviet era. And they've released over 100 declassified historical documents focusing on Nazi sympathizers in New Zealand from the mid-30s until World War II and Soviet KGB officer Vladislav Andreev, who was stationed in New Zealand from 61 to 62 before being expelled. And this is the first release, they tell us, under the declassification program initiated by the former NZSIS director Rebecca Kitteridge. It aims to systematically review and publish intelligence records dating back over 100 years. Most recently, details were released, documents, etc., on the 51 waterfront dispute, some of World War II and the Cold War. So to talk about this and other things, Matt Robson, Auckland barrister, former Minister of Disarmament and Arms Control and Associate Foreign Minister under Helen Clark, as part of the Alliance Party in the Coalition, is back with us. Matt, thanks for coming back.
Pleasure.
Okay, so it's interesting having a skim over some of these documents. Haven't had time to look through all of them, quite a few there. And it's interesting seeing intel gathered in another era, for a start. The receipts from the German clubs of Wellington and Auckland were beautifully handwritten, I noted. And also the talk of Vladislav Andreev meeting people around New Zealand and particularly in the Wellington area and plugging people for information. So that was a different era. It's been decades and decades since all that happened. You would have thought that these could have been released. Maybe they weren't into that back then, but ages ago without having any, security implications.
Well, the problem I have with all of our intelligence gathering, I've no problem with countries. Every country gathers intelligence, and so they should look at threats, is the lack of oversight. That's number one. In terms of our parliament, it's only got a top-level committee which excludes the rest of the members of parliament, and you have to be called a senior member and all that sort of stuff. Whereas most parliaments in democratic systems have a parliamentary committee which all parties can belong to. And clearly there are sometimes, guidelines to say, look, better keep this under wraps for, various reasons. But at least there is an oversight of how they work. And my criticism of all of our intelligence gathering going right back is that it's not for our safety. It's always been highly politicized. Now, you mentioned the German clubs. Well, fair enough. They have a look and see if there's any people singing the Horse Vessel song or what they were doing. But probably it was beaten up as to how much interest Adolf Hitler was taking in New Zealand. And can I just point that out, that there's a tendency, because our intelligence agents, and I've met a number of them both in Parliament and for other reasons, had some visit my home on various issues, and they are quite limited in their view, knowledge of the world. They're called intelligence agents, but they are quite brainwashed people, in my opinion. And I would rather an intelligence agent had an all-round view and not just an ideological view. And what I meaning with that is that my experience has been that there's a sort of a supposition that if we've got a declared enemy, let's say it was under the Soviet Union, Moscow, Maoist China, that the Politburo in those countries are sitting down each morning and top of their list is New Zealand.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about New Zealand? Who shall we spy on in New Zealand? Now, I don't say that all of these countries don't have something in New Zealand, but get some perspective sometime. Do they really spend a lot of resources, a lot of time, a lot of effort on New Zealand? No. But what the intelligence agencies spend a lot of time in is beefing up their position so they get more money and more staffing. And my experience with 9/11 was that was, I'm sure that as individuals, they probably were aghast at the crime that was committed, but it was still an opportunity to suddenly double the budget. Yeah, and so was, unfortunately, the mosque shooting. So just come back to the point that you're really asking about, is that much of it is political. And you mentioned while we were off air, they're looking at the waterfront strike in 51. Well, there we are. I've got an industrial dispute. If you read the papers of the time, and there's been a number of theses, Michael Bassett wrote one and other people have written books on it. The papers were full of that the strike was being manipulated from Moscow. I doubt, you know, Stalin was a bad person. He was a megalomaniac.
I want the wars in New Zealand stopped. You can imagine him in the Politburo ordering his yes.
What was actually a strike over payments of, I think it was blacking or lump payments, I forget now all the details, but, you know, better wages, conditions. And yes, there were communists involved in the trade unions, but as most New Zealanders, who are not communists or left-wing, have realised that quite often many of these people, like Bill Anderson, won their spurs because they were pretty good trade union leaders. And yeah, tough people.
Tough, yeah, negotiators, et cetera, yeah. But couldn't you argue, though, back in those times, talking about the early 60s, that fishing around New Zealand actually also means you can fish around its allies as well in sort of a, like a backdoor way where no one's really paying too much attention, you know?
Probably, but it's still a bit of, okay, so you catch someone doing something and throw them out. But, you know, we had Israeli spies here, took our passports, you know, they got chucked out. We have American spies. All of the embassies spy. Now, some of them, okay, we said they're allies. They don't always tell us what they're doing. So, for instance, WikiLeaks released in 2005, the American ambassador was coming to the parliament spying, had a whole lot of stuff on what he thought of the Clark government, which wasn't much, and how he was hoping that, you know, Don Brash would come in. Or feel like that's what they do. When I was in a backbencher before I became a minister, there was a scandal because the Australians were found spying on New Zealand because one of their spies at a meeting, I think it was in Cairns, that the Deputy Prime Minister, then Winston Peters, yes, even back then he was Deputy Prime Minister, 1998, and the briefing paper they left wasn't flattering about Winston Peters. I took great delight in that, but I was asked, well, what about this? And I said, well, what about it? You know, we spy on, New Zealand spies on people, Australians spy, they all spy. I said, all the embassy spies. Well, the next minute, maybe an hour, down came someone from the Australian High Commission, because this guy used to see me all the time, and said, I'm in big trouble because you said this. And now, you know, they're saying that what we do is spy. I said, well, that's what you do, isn't it? I don't say they were getting the top secrets, but I just want to say, put it in perspective. And my criticism of what we don't know, there's no real oversight of, there is no oversight. There's no parliamentary oversight. They have what they call, you know, I forget what it's called now. I don't know, Jim Anderson was on it. And he told me, they don't tell us anything you can't get in the newspapers. That's what he told me.
I think you mentioned that in the previous chat. Interesting what you say about opportunistic sort of mindset, because wasn't it back in the 30s when they're keeping an eye on the German people through the German clubs and others, that if you were German, didn't matter what side you're on, you're kind of like, sorry, we're taking you out of circulation.
Yes, and the actual genesis of the modern one we've got was post-Second World War. So I think the agencies they had were part of military intelligence, a bit of a mishmash.
Right.
And often I think they appointed British officers because they are apparently more intelligent than we were. I'm not too sure. I think Nikki Hager has written some stuff on this. But yes, and in the First World War, Serbians, you know, Delhi's producing wine up in the valleys out of Auckland, Henderson, they were in prison because they're part of they came from the Habsburg Empire. Now, the fact that there was a Serb that assassinated the Archbishop of Sarajevo and set the whole thing off didn't make a difference. They were still, you know, wogs.
Yeah.
And they stuck them in prison too.
The vernacular of the day. All right, so, and just before we get off talking about this historical stuff, I was quite interested to read the typed memos describing the Russian and his meetings and recognizing all these local places like Petone and Lower Hutt and just trying to imagine that these huge secrets, you know, Cold War secrets are being handed over at G's Fruit and Veg on Jackson Street or something, you know.
and here's something to think about. This guy has to justify his job too. So he's saying, look, I'm finding out a bit about New Zealand and their links to the United States, the mighty United States, and maybe, I don't know, Australians, and a little bit of gossip and, you know, maybe want to blackmail. I mean, you know, the other thing they used to do in those days when homosexuality was illegal, find someone who was homosexual, blackmail them.
Perfect.
All of them did it. All of them did it. You know, you read John le Carré's novels and you see they all did it. You know?
I'm imagining someone like Q, you know, up there at the headquarters in Stout Street, you know, our version of Q. Do you think there's anything in the timing of this release? Is this softening us up for some kind of messaging or what?
Well, they realized they had a very bad PR. Let me give another example. I was a young student under Dr. Ruth Butterworth, and I was getting interested in, you know, all sorts of left-wing and Marxist ideas, and I wanted to overthrow imperialism and capitalism, still do. But, you know, no guns were involved. No, I would have shot myself, you know, just ideas and that. And there was a spy planted in her class. She outed him, and his job was to see what the students were talking about, because it was the beginning of the protests against the war in Vietnam, and what the lecturers were talking about. Oh. He was expelled from the university, but, you know, that's the level of spying on people. And the other thing is, you know, we know that Richard Northey, Labour MP, because he's a peace activist, right through his time he was a member of Parliament. Was spied on. Keith Luck was spied on. I've never bothered to get. I've had people send me. They've gone for their file, and my name's come up, so they sent it to me. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't want to spend their time. I mean, I'll send them if I've had them come to my place. If ever they want anything from me, I'll send them the minutes. In fact, most of these spies, if they spy on like the anti-apartheid movement, they'd probably get bored to tears. Sometimes they might discover something for the police that someone idiot's going to, you know, blow something up. And that, you know, I'm not saying they couldn't discover some idiot, but quite often it's also notorious that spying agencies put agents provocateurs in there to get someone to do something stupid. And the other thing, well, you mentioned about softening up. Well, in the last year, we had Andrew Little, who I know very well, but I think has become a prize idiot, just giving day after day the things the Chinese are up to. Now, maybe they are, but give us some detail. Give us some, prosecute somebody. All you get is the shock, horror, Chinese are doing that. And once again, in my humble opinion, it goes back to the Chinese spending a lot of time on New Zealand. When the war was on in Vietnam, there was a torrent of stuff. You had to be on your toes because the Vietnamese, the Russians and the Chinese, even though the Russians and the Chinese were against each other, both of them were trying to take running Vietnam, apparently, and then they were all going to come down here. And people who were students were their agents, and, you know, that sort of stuff. I don't think we've gone... I think they're a little bit more sophisticated because of the internet and people know what WikiLeaks exposed. I mean, we know that the United States spied on Angela Merkel, their ally. We know they spied on the whole of the United Nations.
They tapped her phone.
Yes.
Incredible.
She's supposed to be on their side. At least I think she was.
If this is for a reason, this timing is a reason, surely, because you mentioned image, you have to, if they feel their image has been taking a hit and maybe they've done, you know, one of those focus groups, maybe they've done a few focus groups.
Yes.
And they perceive that. But also if they, I mean, at this time, it wouldn't be outrageous to argue that creating a perception in the public of us moving closer to traditional allies in a security sense when we have all these conflicts that could spin out of control in the world, you know, you hit two things. You shore up your image, so you're credible, and now here's the message because you kind of know what's ahead. And don't worry, we're with our traditional allies. Everything's as good as it can be. That's what I'm thinking. But,
well, you know, I not having access to tapping mechanisms, I'm not quite sure what they think of it. Yes, I think what in general what you're saying, they're conscious of their image, and probably the bombing or the shooting, sorry, that Christchurch Mosque has reemerged as to their role in that, where they were focused on Muslim terrorists and just missed a right-wing terrorist who'd been in the Ukraine and all over Eastern Europe and came to New Zealand because he could get
a
semi-automatic. They had nothing on it, you know. So they have to brush up their image as though they're...
Well, the disinformation project's gone under this week. I wonder, here we go. You know, it sort of counters the perception of official bodies that might be trying to call out disinformation.
Yes. And they're on to dangerous people and give them some authority when they frighten people off. I mean, take this Chinese stuff. I think I might have mentioned on this program, in Australia it was very virulent And I was, the Chinese ambassador surprised me, wanted to have lunch with him, dinner. I was a friend of theirs, asked me to. He said, "You're just very brave coming here." And I said, "Well, I, Australia might have gone backwards in some ways, but I don't think I'll be arrested. I mean, I might be in China." I didn't say that to him. I wanted a nice meal. But, you know, the fact that, that sort of was around, and it's true. And when I visited the Russian ambassador, I'm told, because, you know, I want to know, what's he thinking? What are he talking about? "You're very brave to come here." So they do an atmosphere of fear, but they're doing it in a more, I think they're doing it more sophisticated, that's all. They've got their better PR now. But, you know, yeah. Anyway.
All right.
I think they're a waste of time, I saw.
Let's just rifle through a few things here. Manawanui sinking. Anything to say about that?
Well,
I know you're not a ship's captain, so I'm not expecting, you know, a breakdown of
I was our defence spokesperson one time. I was once invited to give a talk on military strategy, and I went back and read Clausewitz and told them about that. That's about all I knew. And I thought, I said the Second World War, I didn't think the First World War was a very good idea. Few things like that, but don't think they took too much notice of me. I do feel sorry for the captain, you know, the fact that I think she's not the only captain that a ship has sunk under in the world. So I don't know, you know, the inquiry will say if anybody who was to blame. No idea. All I can say is that it seems a little bit like those pylons that fell over up north where someone took out three bolts. It's a survey ship. I would have thought they would have known there were reefs.
Well, they were mapping a reef at the time, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. They were mapping
a reef. And they can confirm that the reef is dangerous. They actually can confirm that.
But on one serious note, I mean, that's serious, and, like, and I'm obviously, like everybody, pleased that there wasn't a loss of life.
Oh, of course.
But I wonder what they do generally. Maybe that's something that New Zealand being maps a whole lot of the Pacific and feeds it into the in big information data of the new, of the American war machine. They've got to know where reefs are so they don't run one of their aircraft carriers into it.
Good point.
So I'm sure it, maybe they give it to the world scientifically, hopefully. It'd be useful to know a bit about, well, what it used to do, not going to do it anymore. Yeah. What does that give us? That leaves us 8 ships, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think, well, not many, and only I think half of them are actual fighting ships or less.
Ah, well, that's less for the Chinese to worry about.
Don't have to target that one now. All right. Though it's not a war-fighting ship, so it'd be low on the priority list, I think. Okay, recent trip to India. The trade minister's gone over there, Todd McClay, and he's meeting some high-powered people. It feels like with immigration and everything else that New Zealand and India are just sort of like attracting each other, or is it one attracting the other? What do you think?
Well, even when I was in government, Indians were... they were very annoyed at New Zealand. Generally, and they've got a bit of a case, you know, they're not on the Security Council. Here's the second biggest, largest population. They're, you know, a big economy, but they're sort of kept out of the big club. New Zealand and all the European countries come here visa-free. They used to raise this, but they don't, you know, they don't get visa-free. I mean, I'm very liberal on immigration, very liberal. But I understand, you know, if it was visa-free, we'd have a lot of people. We probably wouldn't be able to cope because for so many reasons, genuine reasons, many people want to leave there.
It could be a tsunami, couldn't it? Like a tsunami effect. Suddenly.
Well, yes, you know, things can get so bad for people in India that they just want to get out. You know, I've been to the Punjab and other places. But anyway, then New Zealand's not going to give them that. I mean, I may be wrong. What they sort of argued and what they didn't find out. What I'm more sort of interested in is that McClay, I heard him speak, and not once, at an Indian Newslink evening, so it was dedicated to Indian businesses, and he talked about how they're going to talk to India, and we had a lot to lift our game and a whole lot of buzzwords. New Zealand's got can-do attitude, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, well, I don't really see quite what you're going to offer India. But, you know, China did a free trade agreement without, you know, so much getting back for them. It's more for us. But they did give us that free trade agreement. So I think India could. But it's Firstly, his lack of knowledge. Like, for instance, I'll give you this example. India is one of the BRICS country. So that's moving at a pace. Yeah. That's got a big meeting in Kazakhstan in 2 weeks' time. Yeah. I haven't heard anybody here mention it. The New Development Bank is doing a lot of business. I don't think it's as successful as the BRICS countries wanted it, but the Asia Investment and Structure Bank, what it's called, has got 119 countries. And what I find with when I heard Todd McClay speak, and he had a whole lot of ministers around him at this evening, was not a word on how the world is changing. So I think if you're going to approach India, you'd have to be prepared. It's not a great friend. It's got big differences with China, but it's working some sort of modus vivendi.
Well, China's in BRICS as well, so they get on.
Well, China's one of the founding, BRICS is part of it.
I mean, we should be looking at it, shouldn't we?
Well, we should know about it, yes.
Yeah.
And we should
keep an open mind.
I like it.
Yeah.
And talk about it, understand it. Why have so many countries moving towards it with different political systems, different ideologies? So he's off to, I think he's underarmed, not was that a cricket term? I don't think so. Anyway, he's underprepared, but he might come on your show and say, look, I'm the most prepared trade minister's ever been. The proof will be in the pudding what he comes back with. But India is a complex place.
Yeah, and good luck with that.
Protectionism. Right? Yeah. Protectionism's high. You know?
All right, and the 100, before we get to Middle East, which we'll end on, $100 billion future fund proposed by Winston Peters at their conference in Hamilton the weekend just gone, and he cited some historical examples of that, Singapore and other countries. I mean, it's a big amount of money, but it's not that huge. And he's talking about funding intergenerational infrastructure projects. So that all sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, you know, who would turn down if New Zealand had $100 billion and there was a fund sitting there? Any government could use it, hopefully for good things. But my criticism of him is that it seems to be more or less a gimmick. Lift us in the polls, because it may be the best thing since sliced bread in terms of how we're going to develop. I mean, New Zealand needs investment, in my opinion, needs a big investment fund for its basic infrastructure. We did a real makeover in a whole range of areas. But why not show the costings? Why not give the examples so we can debate with him in the parliament? And, you know, I mean, okay, he wants some political advantage, but it's not going to work to get political. People say, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Give us some clear examples. Tell us how it's going to be funded, because there's been a question raised about whether to get money into it, whether you'd sell assets to these people if they're going to invest in New Zealand. What tax breaks are you going to give them? What's in it for them?
Well, that's what he said, tax breaks. He did say tax breaks. That doing things smarter, you hear this a lot, will mean that we get a huge bang for the buck compared to now. So I do remember him saying that.
To my mind, not being the smartest person in the room, as Wayne Brown always says he is, and I think Donald Trump says it as well, I like to have a large piece of paper with the various data of where the money comes from, where it's going to be. If Singapore has done it well, fair enough. Have a look at Singapore. If someone else has done it well, I mean, there's investment funds all over the world. Maybe he's going to do that. But so the next step is show us, give us detail, and then maybe it's something everybody can join in. And I'll come back to BRICS. It's also another way of raising money for an investment fund is to take loans, sensible loans, what a country can afford to pay back and cost it over a period of time. What's it going to go into? Is it going to go into an industry that's going to future and return? Is it going to help with their health and education, which are part of the infrastructure? Very much detail. And that's why I mentioned even BRICS. It's a possibility. I'd like a wide-ranging discussion on that. And that would take ideology coming down. I've asked the Chinese ambassador here. I said, would you, and I've sent it off to Winston Peters. I sent him a little note saying, look, why don't you look at this? He hasn't replied. Would you be prepared to talk with the BRICS? I mean, he doesn't run the BRICS. It's more countries, but it's based in Shanghai. Would they talk to New Zealand? He said, yes, of course.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing on investment, when the Chinese built the high-speed rail for Indonesia in 4 years, the Indonesian minister said he was approached by the United States and said, well, we're not too happy with you taking this. And he said, well, we'll offer us something better.
Give us a high-speed rail. It's better. Yeah.
You offer us a better deal.
And that's what happens around the Pacific as well, right? That's what happens around the Pacific as well, that China leaves tangible, whether you want to call it a debt trap or whatever, but tangible items of infrastructure that you can actually use, like in drive on and get around on and things like that. And no wonder that it's popular, you know.
Yeah. So I you know, you asked my opinion on it, and I'm, you know, in many ways I'm not the best person because I don't really like him very much. But, you know, you people who don't like and come up with good ideas. And certainly we need to know, I mean, climate change is around. What is this investment fund? What's he looking at? What's he trying to think? What's the payoff? What will be the protections? Now, he may want to work through that. So I would say if he put it up in the parliament, I would say, well, you present a detailed plan which can be looked at, examined, a whole range of viewpoints on it, and then there's a discussion. But at the moment, it's, well, I think I put in some notes I sent to your producer, Bonnie. There was a 1928, Sir Joseph Ward was running for the election. It was the last one, called the United Party. And he couldn't see very well, and he was half deaf. And he read his notes to promise he would borrow £28 million, which was obviously an enormous. It was actually £2 million.
Oh, dear. A Biden moment.
And, well, he couldn't see and he couldn't hear very well.
Poor
and he
bugger.
Was. And he got elected, but then he couldn't raise the money.
Yeah. What do you mean I made that promise? Okay. Just to finish up, I'm going to mention Winston again because last week here, when it started to escalate, well, it's been escalating for a while in the Middle East, Israel, Iran specifically, about a week ago, I asked him, whose side are we on? And he said, the side of peace.
Hmm.
So what does that mean to you?
It means gobbledygook. Now, here I'm. I've obviously had a glass of vinegar before I came on, and I'm sure he'd give it back if you ever asked him about me. I think he called me a lily-livered white liberal or something one time.
Oh, is that all?
Maybe something worse. That was all, or something like that. In the Security Council, he got upset because they were all talking. Another thing about, I mean, fair enough, tell him off is a bit rude, but it might have showed that New Zealand say, well, we're not the most biggest player in the world, you know. But he gave the speech, you know, it's terrible what's happening in Gaza. Well, of course, 40-odd thousand people, maybe more.
Yeah.
Who knows how many under the rubble, kids, snipers,
burned
a conflict.
Up.
Actually, not just going back to October the 7th, not just to 1948, but to the Balfour Declaration, 1917, Winston Churchill and the British saying we're going to put up a state that protects our interests. Okay, there's a lot of history there. But when he gives that speech, we've got to stop and we should have a ceasefire, then he goes straight down to Washington and meets Biden, and I don't believe I heard a word said about the enabler. How can they keep carrying this out? How can they keep firing and killing and expanding and not talking? Because the people he went to talk to, who run NATO, give him the backing, the arms. And that's my criticism of Winston Peters. It sounds good because, and he's probably sincere, he wants the killing to stop. But he doesn't go to the next step and talk to the boss.
Yeah. I'll get back to where we started and why these documents have been released. You know, we're at a weird time, a flux time. And I'm wondering if all this is in play for even someone like Winston having to juggle all this around with that knowledge, but also knowing that, like you say, there are like 30,000 plus kids under the rubble or burned up in tents or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Well, Israel is connected to the Five Eyes. It's a partner. They share, and that's the other thing. You know, I mean, I said he went down to see Biden, but I haven't heard any of them say, well, we're not going to give any intelligence to the
Israel's.
I mean, still a partner of, like many horrible regimes are, partners of the Five Eyes. There's the Five Eyes, the plus seven, the 14, and I think there's about 24, and then there's all of the NATO countries.
Well, he could have said,
and Israel is.
Sorry to jump in, but he could have said, not, I mean, on the side of peace, that's a nice thing to say, but he could have said, we're actually on no side, you know. It's too hard to take a side as such, but it's not that we're not trying to work to help resolve the situation or whatever. I don't know how a politician would say that, but he could have said that rather than just peace. We're on the side of peace.
Yeah, well, that's right. Everybody, I mean, Biden says I'm for peace and then gives them another $20 billion or whatever, rockets and bullets, and then
so we're on
them.
The American-Israeli side is really what that means, isn't it?
It does, underneath it, because, look, Judith Collins is off to the NATO meet defense ministers. I saw her on Jack Tame's program on Sunday. Good on her. It'd be interesting to see if she criticizes any of the NATO countries, particularly the big ones, Britain and Germany and the U.S., for continuing to give cover to what Netanyahu is doing. And, you know, I would take it seriously that New Zealand is taking a principal position, but they want their cake and eat it too at the moment. That's my opinion.
All right, Matt, great to have you back on RCR, Matt Robson, and I look forward to our next chat. Hope it won't be too far away, okay?
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.